All right. Well, thank you guys for coming out. Sorry about the rain. I warned Steve that I have a tendency to bring rain to these events, so at my wedding it rained, so we got it. We got it here. Yep. But so come on down if you can, if you're comfortable out there and you can hear us fine, that's fine. But we're going to get started here. My name is Mark Brush. I'm a senior producer at Michigan Radio, and I've been working there for about 13 years covering environmental issues and doing the online news there. And I don't know how many people here have come to an Issues in Ale before. Do we have any Issues in Ale groupies out there? Woo! All right. So what these are, basically, this is a chance for us at Michigan Radio to kind of take what we do in the studio and get out and do this in a live venue where we go out and talk about important issues facing the state, and legacy pollution is one of those important issues that we're covering today. A chance for us to get out and meet people and hear from you as well. So I want this to be a conversation with our panelists here. So I'll start out asking questions, and then hopefully we'll get to your questions pretty soon here. First, a little business. We want to thank Consumers Mutual Insurance of Michigan for their financial support of Issues in Ale. We also want to thank Amy Smith and the staff at the Old Dog Tavern for hosting us here. So a big round of applause for Old Dog Tavern. All right. And also, we want to encourage you to drink responsibly and tip the wait staff. And it is public radio, so we do encourage you to tip the moderator. Thank you. And tip the other panelists here as well. And the engineer. And one more order of business. Tuesday, October 1st at Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, we'll have our next Issues in Ale. And that'll be hosted by Rebecca Williams, and the topic will be climate change and the effects on fish in the Great Lakes. So come on out to that if you can. So tonight, what we're going to be talking about is how we deal with legacy pollution in this state. I've been covering environmental issues for 13 years, and one of the things that often comes up when we discuss environment these days is that there was a time when there was a lot of pollution in our world, the bygone days. And the big environmental issues today are non-point source pollution, all these other sources of pollution. And that the times when the pollution from the pipes from the paper mills went into rivers are over, that the times when we had coal gasification plants putting soot out in the air, those days are over. But really, those days are not over. We're still living with that legacy pollution, and I'm sure you people here in Kalamazoo feel that pretty acutely. And the question is, how do we deal with it, and how do we move forward and clean up these kind of legacy sites? And so we have a great group of panelists here. I wanted to introduce you to Lindsay Smith, is our West Michigan reporter. Lindsay has won a number of journalistic awards for her great work. She has the tall task of driving around West Michigan and covering these important stories and complex stories for you. And if any of you have heard Lindsay on the radio, you know her kind of straightforward, conversational tone of telling a story. And so we're fortunate to have her here. And Dr. Charles Ide from Western Michigan University. He's a professor of biological sciences there, and he's also the director of the Great Lakes Environmental and Molecular Sciences Center. And he studies industrial contaminants and how they affect our gene activity. And we also have Ann Couture, who's a senior policy advisor to Dan Wyden for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. And she was also the recent acting director of the Remediation and Redevelopment Division. And she's been doing cleanup around the state for 30-plus years, been involved with cleanup programs both in the private sector and also for the state of Michigan. So she's very knowledgeable about these sites. So welcome our guests, and welcome to you as well. What I'm going to do is just have a quick, short conversation here with them, and then we want to throw it open to questions for you. So as I talk with these guys, think about the questions that you have for these guys, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. So first, I wanted to start with Lindsay. Feedback. All right. So Lindsay drives all over West Michigan, and the way she got around was in her Honda Civic, and it had 282,000 miles on it. And if you could tell us a little bit about that Civic and where it died.
No, it died. The funny story really is just that my car that I had had for a decade died behind Kalamazoo City Hall after a city council meeting where they approved spending like some $200,000 on lobbying to lobby to get rid of the Allied site, if any of you guys are familiar with the Allied site. So, yeah, my car died that night. It just couldn't take it anymore. So
now
we had to say goodbye. We got to get a new car. So
she was here covering that story here in Kalamazoo. And I just want you traveled all over West Michigan covering stories. And when you came to Kalamazoo, what was the biggest thing that the biggest impression that left you with that story about the Allied site?
I think that the thing that surprised, there's a couple things that stood out to me about the Allied site. One is just how huge it is. I had driven by it before, but maybe not realized that it was a giant dump. And maybe just thought, wow, okay. But, you know, you're just cruising by. You don't really put it together. So once we went into some backyards, people's neighborhoods, seeing, like, the site is right up against somebody's backyard, a lot of people's backyards, it's a big chunk. It's a big chunk of people that affects. And you usually see those in, like, industrial areas, not in residential areas. And then the other sort of fact that I learned about Kalamazoo is that you've got, really landlocked city in this huge area that could be redeveloped, and that how important that is, especially to city leaders, that potential is there. That seeing that potential, that was the second thing I think that really stood out to me about the Allied site.
The potential there. And that's the thing about these legacy pollution sites. I mean, again, we think of them as being in the past, but I don't think there's a person in here who doesn't drive by or who doesn't see an old gas station that's been shut down, that has the monitoring wells in the ground, or a chain link fence that's the old legacy site has been, covered up. I wanted to ask, one of the big issues here is PCBs, and one of the fun things that we do here at Issues and Ales, we have trivia, and our director here, Steve, will be giving out prizes. So I wanted to ask you guys a trivia question here, see if we can get this right.
Prizes are good.
Prizes are good, yep. Later we'll have trivia questions that come with bonus points, but this one... researchers have tested PCB contamination levels in humans. Where did they find the person who had the highest contamination level? Where did that person live?
Yeah.
Bam, right there.
You're allowed to guess.
Eskimo population? What? An Eskimo population?
That's right. It was an Inuit population in Greenland.
Way to go.
Yeah. An Inuit person. So I wanted Chuck to tell us a little bit more about that and why somebody in Greenland would have the highest contamination levels.
Okay, Dwayne.
Bob's slacking on the job.
Dwayne, can you hear me?
No.
No. Oh,
this one?
Yeah.
Hello.
Okay, try this one.
Strangers in the night.
All right.
No, actually, that song, when I gave my first talk at a major scientific meeting, and I was working, I'm sorry to bore you with this, but I was working at the biophysics department at the Johns Hopkins University, got up in this meeting in Washington, D.C., lights went on, they handed me a microphone, and I started singing Strangers in the Night, and my department chair was very unhappy, very unhappy. But anyway, Dwayne, since you know a lot about PCBs, what tissue do you think had the highest PCB levels in that Eskimo? Well, it's adipose, but it's actually in this Eskimo was brain tissue because it's mostly lipid. And now I just looked it up yesterday because you cheated and gave me the question. it turns out that breast milk and some of the Inuit women would be classified as a dangerous substance. It has so much PCB in it. And why do you think the Eskimos have so much PCB?
Yeah, here.
Right, and then, so why is there so much PCB in the Arctic region up there in the northern climates, as opposed to the equatorial climates? Right, so the PCBs get picked up, taken up high, and then rain down as precipitation in the higher, colder elevations, get into the food chain, and ultimately end up in giant predators like whales, polar bears, walruses, and that's what those people eat traditionally, and so they're very, very contaminated.
And Chuck, can you see PCB contamination?
See it?
Yeah, like if you go or to go out to the riverbanks and look, can you see it?
Well, you can see it in the Kalamazoo River because it's still bound to those paper waste products that are kind of bluish-gray and kind of whitish-colored, but it's not just in them. It's through the whole sediment layer.
So it does give off a color.
PCB is just a clear oil.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got some in my lab if you want to come and
play
with
it. I wanted to ask Anne a question. So you've been doing this for a very long time, and you and I have talked before. When we were talking about these sites and the challenges of cleaning up these sites, you talked about these sites having personalities, that each one has their own personality. Not like they're your children or anything, but you've been involved with them and you know them very well. Sure, we hear about the sites that are, you know, misbehaving, the bad children. Do you think? Can you think of one that was a good child, one that was cleaned up really quickly, that was identified and moved through the process well? And can you tell us about why that was? Why that one happened to be successful?
Sure, Mark. Probably, I think, the greatest success story I've been involved in the past 33 years in doing this kind of work was an old coal gasification site up in the city of Grand Rapids. It was a former Mishcon coal gasification facility, and they had a lot of residuals, you know, still there buried on site. Mishcon was acquired by DTE, and so it was really DTE at the tape. Well, actually, even at the time, I think it was still Mishcon. But there was a proposal to put a MTech center on the property because it was a great location in downtown Kalamazoo. And so whenever you have that interest in someone wanting to invest in a contaminated property, that's the ticket. That's when then you can bring resources to the table because people want to invest. They want to make the property safe to use. And it brings resources to the table that weren't there before and motivation for those who may be liable to get on top of it. So in that particular situation, from the beginning of the interest of Grand Rapids Community College in building this MTech Center, we got the team together that involved MTech, the city of Grand Rapids, who retained me, the Department of Environmental Quality teamed with their grant and loan money, and the libel party all came to the table, and we just were driven. We had a timeline. There were some donations that had some time limitations. And in 18 months, we went from a pretty contaminated site to where most of it was removed and the MTech Center was built. 18 months. And so there's that motivation. You had all the right people at the table. You had the driving force of the redevelopment to move the project. And everyone was part of the team, including the city and the Department of Environmental Quality.
So all the stars were aligned for that project. Was the cleanup itself straightforward? Was it a complex cleanup?
I don't know if there's such thing as getting back to the personality of cleanups.
Yeah.
They always have their
borderline personality
disorders. Yeah, they do. They're all special.
Yeah.
And so, it was, I guess, understandable. It wasn't hugely complex in that, you know, this real thick tarry material is very evident. And so there's that, you know, kind of visual thing versus sometimes are dealing with something you can't see or smell, or we were just talking about nuclear waste and such. So so that could have been an element, but I think it was really that the parties were all motivated and they all had the same goal.
Right. And so with the more complex sites, what are the things that, I mean, we see sites around the state that have difficulty moving to clean up. What's kind of the big thing that you see stalls that?
They're all different. but I think probably the toughest cleanups are the ones like the Kalamazoo River PCBs because of its breadth and length. And, you know, when you have something get into a riverine system, it creates complexities that are even more, make it more challenging. The most complex sites in Michigan are typically our Superfund sites, where the state of Michigan decided that we just didn't have the resources, and so we, you know, basically said, "Feds, you got to come in and help us." And we still stay engaged and partner, but the funding source from the feds can handle some of the much larger, more complex sites, which is why EPA is engaged on the Kalamazoo River
and those sites. So that leads us to our next trivia question. And is Steve ready with the glass? He's ready with the glass. All right. So we wanted to ask if anybody in here knew, how many Superfund sites, active Superfund sites, are there in Michigan currently? We'll give you, within five.
Within five? That's a good margin.
Yeah, that's a huge margin. He's in the back
got
here.
Got a guess.
27.
No, a little higher.
343.
Lower.
343. No, it's not.
Right. Here in the front?
Yeah. Right.
100.
Lower than that. Give you within five. Keep going. Free glass here.
78.
Close, just a little lower.
Under.
52.
Oh, now we need to go higher. Hotter and colder.
All right, come on.
65.
Nice. On the nose. On the nose. 65 sites. Now we have a bonus question to this. There are 1,300 Superfund sites around the country actively currently right now. 1,300 active. Which state has the most? And I'll give you a clue.
All the way in the back.
He said Louisiana.
No.
No.
The back.
No. New Jersey.
Yes, New Jersey. New Jersey has 113 active Superfund sites. All right. So I wanted to, the unique thing about these issues and ALS events are we're not going to be up here as gurus, but we want to get you guys to ask questions of the panelists. So if anybody has a question out there, go ahead and raise your hand, and Steve will come around with the microphone, and we'll try to have one of these guys answer it for you. Steve, over here by the ramp here.
I'm Andrew. My question is about the historical... The longer in the past, like the paper mills, the trees and the sawdust pollution, the collections of sawdust from old lumber mills, is that...
So what's the question?
Is it a problem?
Sawdust pollution.
Oh, sawdust pollution. Is there a concern about sawdust pollution at the old... paper mills. Anne, you want to take that one?
Well, not in and of itself, but you'll often find, since sawdust was a waste product, that we filled in a lot of our wetlands with what was industrial waste. And so in practically every city in Michigan, because we were a pretty big swamp, right? And so cities along rivers, along the Great Lakes, you know, where you had that swampy area and it became developed, they used things like sawdust, but it's often mixed with, you know, the timber and then all the other interesting things. So depending on where you go in Michigan, you might have a lot of foundry sand mixed with that up in Muskegon. And we, you know, and so, and then we have here our, you know, our paper waste lagoons. And so it depends on where you are and what the waste was, because they use it as fill material, and that, and sawdust being one of them. As far as it being environmental problem, I think it's probably, it depends on where it is, but it doesn't leach or, you know, create the kind of problems we have with other hazardous substances. I don't think we consider it a hazardous substance.
Mike Barcelona from Western. I would remind the crowd to remember that the sawdust and other organic materials help concentrate the PCBs, as Chuck pointed out earlier in the discussion. So although they're not a contaminant on their own, they can help concentrate the material.
Is that right, Chuck? Is that how it works? I mean, one of the things I wanted to know is, like, where do these PCBs in the world, where are they coming from?
Well, they come from, you know, all industrial processes where they're used. And
what were they used for? I mean, what was the purpose of
the PCB? Well, the classic PCB was used in the transformer boxes on power poles. And when the transformer boxes, just like right out there, but they don't have PCBs in them anymore, but when they used to wear out, they just dumped them on the ground. Then they'd get into the food chain. And PCBs like to bind, like Mike said, carbon. That's what they really prefer. And so sawdust or wood products or anything that's in the soil, they'll bind really well. But if they get in water, they don't like water so much, so they'll bind the sediments in the water, the little particles. But when they come out of the water, as we mentioned before, they go into the air, and then they travel everywhere. And, for example, this is really a mind-blower, but in Lake Michigan, the Kalamazoo River, the Fox River, Calumet Harbor, all put a lot of PCBs into Lake Michigan. But guess where 10 times more comes from? The air. It just comes right down in the form of precipitation. So, you know, go figure.
So they're binding with these kind of dust particles.
Yep.
Going
exactly.
up in the air and falling yep. in the atmosphere, and that's how
yep.
they move around. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Yes, here in the front. Steve was not paying attention there.
Hi, I'm Dwayne. Yesterday I got the privilege of a guided EPA tour of the Allied Paper Mill waste site. And we sort of have, we're on a fork here. One choice, you know, behind one curtain, $34 million buys you a cap on this essentially 60-acre site, gift wrap for future generations. Behind the other curtain is we dig and haul this stuff for the next 10 years, some of it going to Detroit, some to Marshall, and then we declare victory, but it's going to cost $200 million. My question for Ann is, so the EPA says they've got the money for what's behind curtain one. Is there any chance that if we, quote-unquote, win, they decide for option two, they're going to dig and haul, that they won't actually have the money and it'll just sit there for the next generation?
Well, just like in life, money is a limiting factor in these. Whenever you look at anything, you know, you look at the three-legged stool of sustainability, you know, the environmental, the social, and the economic. And so, yeah, the money isn't there for complete removal. That's not something that we see a lot of anymore, is complete removal. But I don't see it as just two options. I see that we have an opportunity to maybe find a third or a fourth or some elements where we can take what the community's looking for and what the science tells us is a good thing to do. And so I don't think we're at the point yet where it's black and white, A or B. And so the department is going to be partnering with the city, and is partnering with the city as well as EPA, to find out more about the community's concerns and find those options that everyone can say, you know, we can afford this, we can do it in a reasonable amount of time, and we're controlling risk, because in the end, you really. In today's world, we don't clean up. We don't remove everything. We manage risk. And we're pretty good at it in Michigan. We're probably the most sophisticated program in the United States as far as our regulations, our statutory structure, and our practitioners. Because we've been doing it so long, because we have been blessed with a proud industrial heritage, we've been doing it a long time. And so we really have the know-how to manage these. And so up and down the Kalamazoo River, many of you know, we already have areas where we're containing and monitoring the PCB waste because it isn't mobile and in water. And so it's a good approach, and it's working rather effectively up and down the river. So I think we, you know, have options. One of the things I have asked the city to present is their vision for the future use of that property. Because when you have a vision for what you want to use it for, then you have a lot more to work with respect to how you want to manage the environmental issues.
As it was with
issues.
The MTEC site is what you were talking
right.
about.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want to say a quick thing about money, because I did arguably a lot of reporting for me on the Allied site and some other sites around Kalamazoo that are being cleaned up right now. The time-critical ones. And it seems, okay, so unbiased reporter, but this seems like, okay, so get rid of this stuff, right? It's like an obvious, who would be against this sort of a thing if you had all the money in the world. But I did get some emails after those reports from people, particularly in the Saugatuck area, that said, hey, look, if these people suck all the money for this one site in Allied and this whole Superfund site is, you know, the whole stretch out to where we are, and, you know, from my understanding, they're working from this side of the stream that way, are we going to have any money left? You know, like, I don't want them to not get their way, but is there going to be enough money to go around when you get to Saugatuck? So that was something that I didn't even, you know, think about before.
And the Superfund program, it is notorious in that we stopped collecting taxes on these industries in 1995, and the money has gone down since. And I think in 2010, they're spending more money than they're taking into the program. So this is a real limiting factor in cleanup, I imagine. So how are states like you going forward without that fund? How big of an impingement is that money?
Huge. We had two major bond issues in Michigan. The voters voted in 1988 and again in 98 for other substantial funding for environmental cleanup. We were really on the cutting edge of it. And so Michigan was rather flush with our state funds. But, again, just like anything else, you know, it's really hard to find funding these days. And so that's one thing in Lansing we're wrestling with right now is, you know, what should the scope of the program be, and how can we identify a long-term sustainable funding source? Because we've still got a lot more to do, and we are. The feds are running out of money, as is the state. And if anybody has a silver bullet answer, you know, you can speak up. Come see me.
Oh, we have one question down here. Sorry.
You all have a different perspective. Investigative reporter, scientist, administrator. What do you anticipate the Enbridge tar sand spill legacy to be?
That's a good question, because we're talking about legacy pollution here. But are the kind of big hotspots that we're seeing now the legacy pollution of the future? So does anybody want to tackle the Enbridge tar sands, oil-diluted bitumen, what that may do? Or
I'll just make a couple comments with respect to the legacy. One, while it's not fun being the guinea pig, we are really learning a lot from the Enbridge spill. And to Enbridge's credit, a tremendous amount of resources have been put towards that. And so the cleanup was actually, they got at it pretty quickly once they turned off the pumps. but on the cleanup end of things, they've really done a pretty remarkable job. But so the legacy is, you know, the knowledge. I mean, I hope that we're doing things right with this cleanup where we won't have a long-term environmental legacy. But the other legacy I see that I think is a positive thing is that we're a lot more aware of these pipelines and where they are. Now, everybody knows now that, you know, that they're trying to upgrade the pipeline. That's the other, I think, positive thing that's coming out of it is they're investing a tremendous amount of money in replacement of these aging pipelines, just like all the aging infrastructure we have in our country, whether it's sewers or, you know, water pipes or pipelines. And so I think there are a lot of lessons learned from that, and I think we in Michigan are really at the forefront of you know, working with these pipeline companies to you know, be better prepared than what we were. In fact, Enbridge has engaged in we're planning an emergency response activity with Enbridge and all other agencies in the spring at a pipeline area up in the northern part of the state so that our response to these, if they happen again, is more coordinated and more planned. So those are kind of, you know, lessons learned things that I think going forward, though, is a positive.
Yeah, and one thing, I talked with the Pipeline Safety Trust 2 weeks ago, and they were saying that it is a federal regulation that these companies are required to tell the emergency responders that there are pipelines running through their area. But it's not required for the emergency responder to reply to that information. So one thing that people can do is let their emergency responders know there's something here, you should be prepared if, in case something happens. That was the message that I was receiving. Chuck, I want to circle back to you because you had something you wanted to say about the cost, I think.
I think with regard to the Allied site, that's a tricky question because even though PCBs don't like water, they do like to bind things that go into water. And in 2007, the Gazette had an article that said, and I've got it in my office, it said that the aquifer underneath the Allied site was contaminated at a level at 0.3 parts per billion PCBs. So that would be PCBs bound to particulate that came out of the site. Because that site doesn't have a layer in the bottom that's impermeable, and that the DEQ's action level at the time was 0.2, and so they were pumping and treating that water. And so, you know, mitigating risk is an idea, and you say, well, what is the risk then? Do we mitigate it to the point where people won't be eating fish to get sick, but otherwise it's just sitting there, and it may at some point go into the water again? The city's real concerned that it might at some point go into the drinking water. The EPA goes, no, it'll never happen. Well, as Gary says, yeah, your roof doesn't leak now, but what if it leaks in 10 years? You know, then what's the issue? So what really is risk that you mitigate? Is it just today's risk? Is it tomorrow's risk? And this whole thing about funding, you know, it's like, I mean, you can't possibly say and make it your mantra that, well, there's only so much money and there's a lot more PCBs, so what do we prioritize to clean up? You know, I mean, do we leave something alone? It's still a risk, and we clean this up? No, I think what you say is no, we go out and find the money to clean it all up.
Yeah, you know? So from what I understand, the Superfunds, there's 1,300 Superfund sites, and they spend around $300 million a year annually on cleaning up the sites. So it seems small compared to what the need is out there. Yeah,
but there are other ways to get funding. The Congress funds a lot of projects that say, okay, EPA, take this money and clean up that site.
Just like they're doing with the areas of concern.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right, okay.
And so you can't just say, well, let's just let Superfund do it. You have to say, no, let's just get it done.
Okay. Up here in front. Oh, sorry, Steve, I didn't see you. Okay.
I did a little research on this a couple of years ago and found out that you know, Monsanto is the inventor of PCB or the big promoter of it here in the U.S. And the fact is that most of the pollution here on the Kalamazoo River watershed is due to recycling of no carbon required paper, okay? And the thing is, we look at the Allied paper site and there's a serious pollution problem there, but I believe from what I've read with EPA papers, that the biggest, most problematic areas are actually the dams on the Kalamazoo River downstream, of which there's maybe 5-6 left. And the largest, of course, is Allegan Dam. And the question is, what do you do with something that big? Because that's a pretty good-sized lake there.
And so that's another environmental conundrum where we hear that removing a dam really helps the ecosystem. It helps the fish move up the stream, but you've also got to take in consideration there might be some really bad things behind that dam. Does anybody want to talk about that, the problem with the dam, Charles or Lindsay? Yeah?
I mean, I know that there, there's all kinds of controversy around dam removal from not only PCBs, but sea lampreys and, you know, fisheries, all kinds of stuff like that. So I think that there's a lot of factors that influence dam decisions besides, you know, the pollution. For example, Enbridge in the Suresco Dam, I think that they have acquired the Suresco Dam, I want to say, or they're in talks about it the last I knew. And I talked to a DEQ person the other day who said they want to get rid of it as soon as possible. Any funding that they can find for it, just get rid of Suresco Dam. And I don't know, is PCBs a Suresco problem? Not that far up. Okay.
The Enbridge.
Well, yeah, right. But it's, I think it's the dams get complicated. And as far as whether or not, you know, how big that is, I know when we were talking about dredging, this is another Enbridge, but if you're taking material out from behind the dam, truckloads and where you're going to put it and how long does it take? Does it take months? Does it take years? Does it influence, you know, that neighborhoods and that city, obviously? So, I, you know, it's hard to give you just a sort of simple, this is how it should be done and this is how they make the decisions. It's, I feel like it's really complicated.
Okay, time for one more trivia question. And we'll get, next trivia question, then we'll get to your question here in front. So what is the most toxic man-made substance known? Does anybody know that answer?
Plutonium!
Most toxic?
Just say organic chemical.
Organic chemical, I'm told to clarify. Substance was the word that tricked up. Okay, organic chemical. Anybody have the most toxic man-made organic chemical? They're dealing a lot with it. In Kalamazoo, you deal with PCBs. Midland, they deal with this chemical quite a bit. Tittabawassee River. Dioxin. Who said it? All right. Yeah, so we'll start. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I had all kinds of questions.
We'll get your glass.
I had all kinds of questions before I came here, but I'm an opportunist, and I see the panel, and I wish I could ask three questions because there's three people up there. But, Chuck, could you give us a picture of what kind of damage the PCBs do to us, both genetically and otherwise?
Right. That's a really good question. And if you are exposed to PCBs at a high dose, if you're an adult, then you can have bad things happen to you. But they're more dangerous to developing organisms like fetuses. So if you're a kid exposed in utero because your mom really liked to eat Lake Michigan fish, big salmon or something, then, you know, you might have a problem. PCBs and dioxins all kind of do the same thing. They bind a funny receptor in your cells that kind of evolved to bind materials that came from fire, let's say. You know, or they're called aerial hydrocarbon receptors, so they bind chicken wire-like organic molecules that come from burned things. So anyway, what happens, a little bit of that goes a long way. When you get a whole lot, like PCB or dioxin, you overwhelm that system, and it turns on all kinds of really weird gene expression in cells that cause cancer, cause birth defects, immunosuppression, bad skin diseases, I mean, you name it. And we did some studies on tadpole development where we exposed them to low levels of PCBs. And, you know, an adult frog just kind of, you know, goes, well, whatever. But these tadpoles were very sensitive. And it was kind of like when you have a hangover, you know, the next day after you drink too much. And you say, oh, the hair of the dog that bit me. I'll take a little bit of a beer for breakfast and I'll feel better. Well, when we gave the tadpoles a little bit of PCBs, their genes all perked up. And they went, oh, we can deal with this. We gave them a little more, and they went, oh, we think we can deal with it a little more, and pretty soon all the gene expression just plummeted a little more, and they were dead, you know. a lot deader than a frog would be. So the developing organisms really have a problem.
Good evening. I have a question about aerochlores, PCBs. Like dioxins, they're actually a mix of many different chemicals. I'm curious as to whether any studies have been done to say that the materials that are PCBs that are still in the sediment are more or less toxic today than they used to be. Given that, for example, Eskimos have a lot of PCBs, and it was never there. It had to come from somewhere. So those chemicals, at least, are no longer here. I know from personal experience that aerochlores were anything from a very volatile, pale liquid through yellow, hard resins that make damn good tackifiers for adhesives used in those days. Made them fireproof, in fact, because they're so highly chlorinated.
So the question is, have there been studies done on whether they've changed
toxicity? Yeah.
Toxicity.
The toxicity of the sediments, does it change with time?
Well, sure. I mean, PCBs do weather to some degree. And over time, the ones that have lots of chlorines decorating them will lose some of those chlorines. But they still are toxic. Almost, I mean, all the things that are in aerochlore are pretty toxic. Some more than others.
Are they as toxic now as they were then?
I think everybody pretty much thinks that because an aerochlore has 209 different congeners in it, that it remains toxic for a long, long time, very long time. Now, if bacteria get a hold of it and try to break them down, they'll do some damage to the PCBs and make it somewhat less toxic, but it's still toxic for all practical purposes. At least that's what I've seen.
Okay, another question. Did you have a question? Steve, here in the front, white shirt. Steve, here? Yep.
All right. I just have sort of a general question about what aspects or challenges you find, you know, when you're managing legacy pollution are the most difficult, whether that's scientifically, socially, or economically.
What are the biggest challenges, I guess? Does one rise to the surface as opposed to the others?
I think they're all difficult, and I'll go back to what I said before. Every site has its own challenges and its own quirks, and while there's commonalities, I can't really say that there's one that's more wicked than another, because when you really, you know, get into these, it's difficult all the way around.
There was one site you and I were talking about, and I was reading up a little bit last night. Does everybody know about the PBB contamination in Michigan, of course, if you're older? So the one thing that I was surprised to learn was that that is ongoing. In St. Louis, Michigan, they're still cleaning up those chemicals. In fact, I think it's one of the biggest Superfund sites in the region. So that one is pretty difficult. Why is that one difficult?
Well, Velsicol is really difficult because it was a chemical plant right on the shores of the Pine River in the little town of St. Louis in Gratiot County. So they manufactured all kinds of chemicals, DDT and the PBBs that got mixed up with the animal feed. That was the plant where it occurred. So what happened initially when they found the PBB mix-up and then we started to look at Velsicol Chemical, they ended up demolishing the chemical plant on the site and burying it and containing it. And so what we came to find out, and this was in the early days when we weren't as sophisticated, I hope, as we are now, is that the system leaked. In fact, when they were putting in the containment system, they used a slurry wall along the river. And even when they were installing it back in the early 80s, I think they ran into over 70 pipes, direct pipes, that had a direct discharge into the Pine River. And so this was a, you know, chemical manufacturer, and
literally used the river as its waste dumping site. And so,
I was going to say, if I had to vote, I'd vote economics all day long. I really feel like if we had all the money in the world, legacy pollution would be easier to deal with. I mean, it's like what you were saying earlier, and then turned and said, it's so idealistic, you know, or, you know, that, I mean, in a way, it's you know, get out there and lobby the EP. Well, I guess you're, but it just seems to me that a lot of the sites that I see, it comes down to, well, who's going to pay for it?
Well, you know, one of the things that really annoys me being a scientist is that scientists spend their whole lives, you know, finding the truth. And then, so, for example, EPA, DEQ, Department of Community Health, do a risk assessment about PCBs in the river. And they say, if you really want to protect everybody who eats fish, and lots of people do, you have to clean it up to 0.05 ppm in the sediments. So then when EPA does a cleanup, they clean it up to maybe 5, maybe 1, maybe half a ppm, but it's still 10 times higher than what they said it should be. And so you go, well, why is that? And then the second issue is like this Allied site. EPA says if you have all that nasty stuff there, it should have a liner. And then they turn around and say, but for you, we don't need a liner. And then you go, wait a minute, where's the truth here? You know, I mean, do you have policies? And if you do, why aren't you holding to them? But then what's the answer? Money.
Okay. I'd like to speak to that, too. One of the things, though, in managing risk is we accept all different kinds of risks in our society. And so as a society, we've got to figure out what's the proper calibration. How much should we be putting towards this particular issue when we've got a lot of other risks that need to be managed and things that we need? So it's you know, it's a balance again. And you want to make sure that in, you know, seeking to try to get everything cleaned up, that you're not taking valuable public resources away from other risks that we face, whether it's, you know, poor roads that cause traffic because the potholes are so big, or the myriad of risks we face. And so there's always got to be that consideration.
Pull and push for these, for those kinds of resources. Are there any other questions?
Yes.
The woman in the blue shirt back here? Yep.
How many people have noticed the proliferation of pink garbage cans? You know what that means? That means cancer. Any comment from anyone on the connection, please?
Are these environmental contaminants, what do we know about their link to cancer? Is that the kind of the question? Yeah. So, that is one big thing. We did a documentary on cancer, and one of the big things out there is people, when they first hear that word cancer, they begin to circle back and think, what happened in my life? And a lot of people come up with, I was exposed to something. Can you answer those questions now as a scientist?
Well, somewhat. I mean, it's like, you know, when the EPA does risk assessment, they have a system that they study almost every chemical, and they try to figure out what its greatest risk is, and they use cancer as their main endpoint. And then for that risk assessment I talked about that the DEQ did for the Kalamazoo River fish eaters, and also the Michigan Department of Community Health, again, it was cancer as their main endpoint. Because, I mean, you know, if your IQ goes down, or, you know, some of these other, your immune system goes down, some of these other effects are nothing like cancer. I mean, that's a end point, you know, end game. You know, it's just a really bad thing.
Why is it difficult to link these chemicals to cancer? I mean, we often hear, you know, it's a potential cancer causer. Why don't we know?
Well, it's because what modern medicine's finding out as we sit here right now is that everything in life, when it comes to disease and health, has both a genetic component and an environmental component. And some of you had your DNA analyzed by 23andMe or one of those companies, and they'll give you your health risk effects for many, many diseases. Just from the way your DNA is made up compared to other people's who don't get those diseases. And so some people have a tremendous risk for some, like myself, I have a big risk for type 2 diabetes, like probably more than anybody here. And that's what my DNA says, but not so much for cancer. So if I get exposed to PCBs or something, maybe I won't get it. But if I eat a, you know, cookie, I'll get diabetes. You know, it's just the way it is. So I think that's the big, it's genetics that's going to solve all this.
So you think in the future we'll get a profile of ourselves and we'll be able to say, you stay away from something like the Allied Ciders?
Absolutely, and that's already happening.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like the question you need to ask is, what are these companies going to do with the property when they're done with it, rather than asking us what we're going to do after we have to clean it up? I mean, we don't want to tax people. We don't want to regulate people. God forbid that we should interfere with, you know, capitalism. But, geez, you know, how about asking them, what are you going to do with this piece of property when you're done with it? Make them take out an insurance policy. Make them carry some liability. This is nonsense.
Polluter pays. Andy, you want to talk about the challenges of... The thing that strikes me when I was driving up here was I did that a story on a gas station that had... overnight lost its entire inventory. They went to check the tanks underground, and all the gas was gone. So,
right here in Battle Creek.
Yeah, in Battle Creek. So Logan's Gas and Deli. And so the state spent about $1 million to clean that up. But what happened was that the polluter pays. This guy dropped the gas. But what happened, I think, is that his LLC went bankrupt, and getting him to pay proved difficult.
Yeah, very difficult. It's, you know, piercing the corporate veil. It's the LLC chess game that people can play. And so you do have a lot of those situations where the person really responsible, sometimes gets away. But a lot of our legacy issues, there is no one there other than we who live in the vicinity. The companies are gone. There's no one to go after. And so with respect to your comment about, you know, what are you going to do with the property, a lot of time these properties are in public ownership. But if you can look at what do you want to use that property for? What's the community's vision for that use? Again, you can tailor the risk management and the response activities to the future use.
Can I say something really quick on the LLC note? Because I think what you're saying is there anything you can do up front maybe to ensure that, yeah. Unless the regulations are there, that people really push lawmakers in a certain way, a lot of that doesn't happen. Because we like to say, well, it's going to be an economic investment and we're going to create jobs. One thing, just a real quick note, because I saw a Palisade sign out here earlier and I know it's come up once, right? So one of the things that the anti-nuclear people argued when Entergy is the company that owns Palisades right now, but it used to be owned by Consumers Energy. And one of the things that they argued was, Entergy created an LLC to buy Palisades. So, you know, it's like they said, look, the writing's on the wall. But that wasn't, you know, and that was something they brought to the Michigan Public Service Commission and something that they argued to the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to say, you need to deny this sale. And it was something that was talked about, but obviously it didn't.
Yeah, the Center for Public Integrity did a ton of research on the Superfund sites, and they followed the paperwork and the number of companies that just split off. It became really difficult to trace them down, to track them down, because of the complexity of these transactions. Any other questions? Back in the back.
Yeah, first of all, as a society, if we stop focusing our energy on maintaining an empire and enriching the already very wealthy, we would have plenty of resources to address these issues. And I would like to bring up Palisades, which was a lemon when it was built. It continues to leak radiation into the environment constantly. Please eat your miso soup. It is an effective therapy. But if we can't get out ahead of the problems that we're creating today and all we can talk about is people who took their money out of Kalamazoo or out of wherever in Michigan or wherever on the planet and then skated and then we can't get the money back, and then we don't have the resources. We need to get ahead of our problems and shut down Palisades before it's Fukushima. If it becomes Fukushima, Lake Michigan is dead.
So the this kind of segues into a question I wanted to ask Lindsay about, is because she's been at Palisades, she's been there, and we're talking about legacy pollution, but so one thing that really struck her, she when she came back, she told me about it, and it was what did you see there?
You're right in that it is an older plant. It was one of the first plants that was built. It's 40 years old. So you know, when you go into the control room of Palisades, it is impressive on one hand, but you can. It's like to me, it's like, you know, like the old school Star Wars. Like I can see like, oh, this is from 1970. You know, I mean, just because I'm not 30, so I feel like it's obvious to me that this is like not how you would build, you know, our radio studios have sweeter computers or whatever, you know, or whatever. But honestly, what hit me more is when you go outside. You go outside and it's right on Lake Michigan, and it's tucked in between these dunes. You know, it's like buried kind of in there, down in there. And off to the side, when you walk to out of the building, and you can walk down this driveway, and there's to actually see the casks that once they every 18 months they have to shut down and pull some of their fuel out that's spent fuel rods, and then put in new ones, and then they put the old ones in the cooling pool to cool for a few 5 years, 6 years before they put them in. Casks, and they put them in these dry casks. They sit upright. They're about, I don't know, 20 feet, 30 feet tall. Maybe not that tall, maybe 20 feet tall. And there's like 17 of them, just, you know, like kind of dominoes, you know, a couple little right tucked in the dunes. And just that there's no plan, Yucca Mountain's not on the table. Like, that's when it really, like, I feel like every energy source that we have has arguably some drawbacks. And so the big one with nuclear, in my mind, that was like the home hit, like, oh, this stuff's just gonna
there
sit
it is.
There.
Yeah, there
and
it is.
And we add a new one every few years, you know, plunk another one down there, and there's no, you know, plan for really what to do. They don't take up that much space, but
right. So our children are gonna have to be dealing with that in the future. That legacy pollution. Any other questions? Yep.
We heard a lot about one of the limitations is being money. So maybe this is just rhetorical, and we put a lot of responsibility into Superfund program. But what happens when that money runs out? You know, we have something that we need to think about. And we have a representative from the DEQ, from academia, and from the media. So maybe each of you can tell us, you know, if anything is being done, or, you know, what's being done to maybe inform people about the risks that we face when the money does run out for each department, I guess. So,
I'm gonna start. we have initiated that discussion and are actively engaged in that discussion in Lansing. We have put together a nice PowerPoint presentation of sites in Michigan. We call them our top 10. Really, really big, complicated sites, but with a good ending. But it also has a big price tag. And so, you know, we are telling the story, and that's what we're trying to do now, is get out there and make sure we educate people, tell them the story so that they understand the need, especially our politicians. And so we are actively engaged in telling that story. One of the things, I just recently came back to state government after being in the private sector for 17 years. And one of the reasons I came back is that the program in Michigan is a mature one, but we needed to kind of put it into the 21st century, up our game a little bit, be more efficient, you know, use better technology, upgrade our rules and such. And so we were told to get support for the program, they wanted to see the program be run more efficiently. And so we've done that in Michigan, and we've done some pretty seriously program reinvention. And so I think we're poised to say, okay, we held up our end of the bargain, and so we are making the case. We're telling the story. Here's the need, and it's huge. The likelihood of another bond issue, though, like we'd had in 88 and 98, is not good because we're still paying the debt on those. And so from a financial standpoint, it hasn't really worked out the best. But we are looking at different kinds of funding structures and fees. And what's really important, I think, is to find a nexus between how you fund something and what it is you're funding. And that's also, like, for example, is there going to be a fee on a generation of waste or a tipping fee or whatever the case may be that has that kind of nexus to clean up? But there are a lot of competing programs as well, the solid waste program, the hazardous waste program, the wetlands program. Everybody has these needs. And so we're really looking carefully at how to roll those up so that we can get some fees to have long-term sustainable funding, but there's always got to be that nexus of the fee to what it is you're trying to fund.
And how have the fees been in the state in terms of the money that's there to clean these places up?
Well, it hasn't been based on fees. It's basically we've been using, well, we work with liable parties, and there is always that money, and then the bond issues in 88 and 98 have been the greatest source, plus the federal Superfund money. We also get, for those of you who don't like to return your bottles, if you put your cans and bottles with the 10-cent refund, if you don't take them back and get your 10-cent back, if you put them in the recycling, the state tracks that, and it's called the escheats. And we get between $9 and $11 million a year for our cleanup program just from those bottles that don't get returned. So my bottles go into my recycling.
And we pay a 7/8 of a cent tax, a penny on gas?
Well, that's on the Refined Petroleum Fund. Yeah. You're also paying 7/8 of a cent, which was a political number.
Less than a penny on each gallon of gas.
Yeah. To help pay for orphan leaking underground storage tank sites.
Okay. So, Chuck, you want to...
Well, I just wanted to comment that, I worked for about 10 years doing environmental things at Tulane University in New Orleans, and Louisiana is a very polluted state. And I spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., a lot of time. I even set up a Louisiana swamp 3 times in Washington, once in the House, once in the Senate, and once in the Department of Energy building. And the whole idea there was to convince Congress that environmental issues in Louisiana were really important and they should put more money towards dealing with those issues. And oddly enough, it really worked sometimes. It depends on your congressional people and what sorts of powers they have. Because those budgets aren't set in stone. Every year, everybody fights tooth and nail to get new things and take things out. I mean, it's not like every agency, has this budget that's there. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the federal government has money, and it's just how you get to it to fund your issues in your state that you just have to have a different sort of approach.
You're saying that... if the funding's running down, how do you make sure that we take care of these problems still or are aware of the problems? Yes? Yeah? Okay. Being a media person, I'd love to say, we do a fantastic job. You should listen to us all the time. And you should. And we do. Mark does.
Yes, I listen.
But, I would say like the competing interests for dollars, I have competing interests for, you should cover this. I'm a general assignment reporter, I cover all of West Michigan. Good luck. there's a lot to do. So I have competing, you should cover this education story. You should cover, economic development. We're going to make new jobs. Today I wrote some big story about potash, and that's going to be a new big boom in the state. I think people who listen and are in the know with Michigan Radio or with whatever new, I encourage a broad source of news. Also, I feel like these are the same people over and over. Like, I can only tell so many people, and people that are interested, if you have a cause, you have a concern, you become the nagging friend. You become the person that is at dinner parties that's talking about Palisades or whatever it is that you care about, because it's like, you know, I don't know how much more exposure. I feel like also people's personal interests makes a difference. If it's your friend that's telling you, hey, did you see what they're doing over on Portage Creek? And did you know that this is, I mean, I don't know if people know, and if they don't know what they don't know, it's hard for them to care. And I think obviously petitioning, bringing a swamp to your congressman is... Washington was built on a swamp, wasn't it? Yes. But I also think, I mean, I think the media really, we chase conflict too. So if there isn't a huge, like, this is causing cancer and you need to cut, I mean, that's an obvious story. But if it's like, risk, it's not that risky. It's like, it might not get covered, you know?
Yeah.
As much.
And there's, and another reason why we're out here is, We don't know everything at Michigan Radio, so we really want to hear from you guys about what stories are out there to tell, to talk about these legacy pollution sites. Question here in the back, man with the brown shirt.
Hi. Yeah, without anyone having any economic incentive to do so, is anyone ever going to get behind microenergy as a solution or a mitigating factor to a lot of our pollution issues? For example, instead of giving a bunch of money to the Palisades Center right at their insurance because they can't buy insurance with a risky energy scheme, why not give that money to homeowners to make investments in real energy efficiency solutions and wind turbines on their house and solar panels? Give that money to us instead. Let us generate energy at home, where it's much more efficient and way closer to the end user, and we don't have all these pollution issues from the inefficiency.
All right, so great. All right. Any questions out there?
Hi. I'd like to focus on two legacy issues. One is, remember that the Enbridge oil spill occurred when the river was about 125% above floodplain level. So a lot of land on the shoreline got oiled. We've done some sampling, found out that there's polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, incomplete combustion products of organic compounds like tobacco, that are persistent in the soils in these largely agricultural areas, agricultural and natural wetland areas.
So is the question, are people paying attention to those?
No, well, just remember that that's never going to get cleaned up.
Yeah, they've said as much. It's not all going to be cleaned up.
No, it's never going to be cleaned up. The second thing is...
Do you have a question for the panel up here?
No.
Okay.
I love them, but, you know, Chuck will get...
You can phrase it as a question. Does anybody else have a question out here that they can ask the panelists before we have a short...
Go ahead. We just did some work on the KHL landfill, which is a landfill adjacent to Doxa Trucking and KMR Metal Recycling. There is methane being emitted from that site constantly, and it's got the same contaminants in it that the Allied site has.
Okay.
So there's no way that there's not methane coming out of the Allied site.
Okay, I want to get to a question that somebody has in the audience here. Man in the hat, Steve, back here.
I used to live in Houghton, up in the UP, and not too far from the Torch Lake Superfund site. And they still have problems with arsenic in the water over there, and they still have drinking warnings for children under the age of 5. And we were talking about risk and risk mitigation, and if there's dioxin in Midland and there's PCBs here, are they defining which are the most important and which need to be cleaned up the most, which affect the population the most and the most population centers?
Yeah, so, Ann, you've said the state's gotten really mature at assessing risk. Yeah.
But you're asking how you prioritize, and it really isn't, I mean, each one of those sites has different resources coming towards it. For example, in Dow, it's Dow Chemical putting the resources forward. Torch Lake, you know, we have federal and state resources. And so it really, while we used to have a prioritization scheme, but it's not like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You try to really, these things are sequential. They take a long time to understand, you know, before you get to the end results, the final remedy. And so, you know, we do have enough funds where we can manage hundreds of sites at one time. And so it's not going to be a sequential thing.
So
But clearly, when we see, we do risk management, and so when we see unacceptable exposure, that jumps to the top. There are a lot of sites where we know there's contamination, but there isn't any unacceptable exposure occurring. So, and so those are going to, you know, we still track them, but they may not get the resources until we get more resources.
All right. Any other questions? Yeah, here.
This is more of a comment, but I'd sure appreciate any comments on it. Regarding impediments to dealing with these legacy costs, economics was mentioned. Science was mentioned. Inseparable from those is politics, obviously. And 18 years ago, when John Engler split the DNR and the DEQ, that was pivotal. I don't think it did either agency any favors. And part of the fallout from that, this is just one example, oil and gas pollution from historic oil and gas production in Michigan, of which there are scores of sites that haven't been cleaned up for decades. Now we're in the midst of a new oil and gas revolutionary, wonderful boom that's sweeping down the state. When Engler split in 1995, DNR and DEQ, he did away with a public database called the Site Assessment Program, where anyone could access pollution via oil and gas contamination anywhere in the state. That's gone. So now you got to FOIA this stuff, which is expensive, time-consuming, and it should be unnecessary. So that's just my comment is, you know, the politics is at the inseparable from economics, science, and social issues.
So, yeah, how accessible is this information to the public? And
we actually have an inventory. And the old Act 307 list is what we used to call it. And that list still exists. It's not used quite the same way, but we do have online an inventory. And we're getting ready to roll out within another month a really upgraded kind of inventory that you can search to determine, you know, where you might have a contaminated site that the state knows about. So that is available, not necessarily through FOIA, but just through databases.
One more trivia question. Do you have a glass, Steve?
One more.
One more, okay. He's not.
Right. You're making me work here.
They identify leaking underground storage tanks in the state. There's a program called LUST. There have been LUST. An unfortunate acronym, leaking underground storage tanks.
I got it.
How many leaking underground storage tanks are in the state that remain to be cleaned up? And we'll take you with it. We'll guess in the.
Come on, guys. These guys should know.
9,000?
Yay! Bingo!
Wow, that's good.
That was great. All right, see, Steve, that was painless.
Yeah, okay. You get some backup there.
All right, yeah.
I think you did.
Okay, good. All right, so are there any more questions? Here we go, okay.
I hear people talk a lot about what is spilled on the ground, but I don't hear a lot of people talk about what the ground is that it's spilled on. Seems to me that it's very important to know when you put something organic on the ground, whether you're dropping it on calcium carbonate or you're dropping it on a zeolite clay that might be a catalyst for turning it into several thousand more toxic things than it already is.
You know, that's a really good point. And I had a program at Tulane, and one of our scientists went to a DOD site and found some sludge that had been dumped there, you know, hydrocarbons, and sampled it and found a fungus that was in it that was breaking down these sludge contaminants. And everybody got excited, said, oh, let's patent this bug, you know, let's make it, this will clean up the environment. But then she looked at the metabolites that came out of those fungus fungi, you know, to see what they were actually making. And they were making the world's most carcinogenic compound. benzoapyrene. So the point is that when something spills, you don't know what you're going to get in the environment.
That does come into consideration in a cleanup, you know, where it landed. It's not as if we're controlling it, right, but it's where you find it. And so if you find a compound in sand versus clay, you know, there's different ways to manage things, and you also have different routes of exposure. The vapor intrusion pathway, for example, with a sandy soil is going to be a lot easier to get vapor intrusion and vapor coming into buildings than if you have clay. So you are considering what it landed on, or even sometimes it's not even a soil material. It might be historic fill, for example. So, but you deal with it where it's there. But the science of environmental cleanup absolutely takes that into consideration. As you know, what kind of media is it in?
It's part of the risk assessment that you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Oh, yeah, here.
Pardon me. Aside from preaching to the choir, as we seem to be doing, you asked for something original. Now, I'll date myself. Upjohn drilled a well a long time ago, and they started pumping all their crap about 4,000 feet down. And they've been doing it, what would that be, 40 years now? And I'm asking you all, is this on the menu?
On our radar screen, Upjohn. I have not. Oh, and Portage. Okay. It is now. Yeah.
Down in Portage, the well was dug, and they started pumping crap.
Right.
All their bad chemicals. They just said, well, if we send it a mile down, nothing will ever happen.
Deep injection well.
And now, we're fracking, and we're, playing with all that stuff. And I'm saying, I'm just asking, you wanted something new to think about.
Right, yes, thank you.
This is old.
It's old.
Get used to it.
The deep injection well, yeah. There's one in Romulus as well. Yeah. Well, that one's been on our radar screen, but this Upjohn one is
the Romulus well. Yeah. There are other ones throughout the state. It's, you know, it's called Underground Injection Control. It's a UIC program run by the feds. And all I will say here is that it is a regulatory program, but I've never been a fan.
You know, so, can I comment on that?
Yeah.
Again, in my favorite state, Louisiana, this company called Freeport-McMoRan was dumping railroad cars of hydrochloric acid into a deep injection well. Railroad cars. And they said, it's okay, it's deep. Well, there was a reporter on the news who busted them and said, you know what, that stuff's coming back up, and it's going to dissolve the community, okay, and it's ruining all the groundwater, and the people had to move out. And so the reporter was a hero, except to Freeport-McMoRan. And then suddenly, about 2 weeks later, he goes, by the way, this is my last newscast. I'm going to work for Freeport-McMoRan. And they bought him. So you won't be bought, I'm sure. Anyway.
Lindsay, do you have a comment?
Mark my words. I'm not going to be working for Entergy or Enbridge anytime soon.
Okay, so we've been informed I have about 5 more minutes, so maybe time for 1 or 2 more questions. Sorry. In the back here.
Thank you. I'm sorry I just came in, but we had our shutdown Palisades organizing meeting. So I know Palisades, the word's been brought up. I know you're talking about the legacy of pollution in the state of Michigan. But at this point, I think it's so important that we make these connections of pollution, all different types of pollution. And I know there's health effects from every single one of them. And what makes it difficult is that they sometimes are latent effects to where we can sit back and, as everyone knows, and just says, oh, wow, is it going to really affect me? So let's realize that it does affect us. Let's realize that thank you all for all of the professional and scientific information that's so important. But it's really up to us to keep that connection. For instance, with Palisades, we live within the 50-mile radiation zone. We could have another Fukushima over there. It's one of the worst plants in the country. So anyone who wants to just do a little thing to get involved would be so cool.
Great.
That's all
Thank
I wanted
you.
To say. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I think up here in the front we had a question. Yeah.
Last question.
Last question of the night.
I wondered, the Enbridge spell, which I just heard recently on NPR, was the biggest interior spill in the country.
The biggest inland.
It happened in Marshall, which is not far upstream from Allied, or where these paper companies are. What if that spill had happened downstream from there? They had to clean it up down here. Would there be a Legacy Squared problem? Would they be digging up sediment that also was polluted with PCBs? Would they be responsible? It just seems like it would be just an incredible legal environmental mess.
And would that just stop everything? Maybe, yeah.
I'd retire.
She's like, I'm out. You guys are so
no, believe
on your
me,
own.
I mean, that was a real, scary thing to think if it got past the dam at Morrill Lake, the Morrill Lake Dam, because that's where we start with the PCB problem. And it was very, very close. And it would be just a nightmare legally, technically, financially. And so, if we're lucky, maybe that's the wrong word, but we are lucky that it didn't do that because, first of all, the lawyers would all get rich because there'd all be, who's going to pay and what's the allocation and such. And frankly, a lot of these sites, especially Superfund sites, a lot of the money goes to transaction costs and to attorneys and to a lot of long calls with a lot of consultants. It's not an efficient process. I would challenge Superfund to step up like Michigan did, reinvent their program, and get the resources in the ground going to cleaning stuff up.
I think one of the real problems would have been most of the PCBs are in the banks of the Kalamazoo and behind the dams. And if that oil got up on the banks and dissolved the PCBs, because oil and PCBs like each other, it would go back into the food chain major. So then we'd have an ecological disaster in addition to everything else.
Lindsay, from your experience?
I was just going to point to Chuck and say that, right now even the costs for between the oil spill cleanup costs and the PCB costs I've heard, between the two, it's a $2 billion, restoration. Easy. Is it easy? Is that what you just said? Easy $2 billion. So, billion, yes, with a B.
And do they have the money?
the money's always the problem.
Right. All right, well, thank you all for coming out. I wanted to thank our panelists for joining us. Give them a round of applause. Yes. And thanks to, I want to thank our financial supporter, the Consumers Mutual Insurance Company of Michigan. And the Old Dog Tavern, thank you so much for hosting this event tonight. We really appreciate it. Yes. And I'm serious when I say that, I've been covering environmental issues for a long time, and there's a saying that the environmental issues don't break, they ooze. They happen slowly. So we really want to hear from you guys. If you know stories that we should be covering, it's important that you contact us and let us know, and we'll work to cover those stories. So thanks for coming out, you guys.